Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. Today I'm talking with Alan Gura, the lead lawyer in D.C. versus Heller, the big D.C. gun ban case. Alan, what are the facts of this case?
The facts of this case are fairly simple but quite stark. Washington, D.C. bans all guns in the home. There's a complete ban on the possession of handguns. And also, while they allow you technically, at least in theory, to have a rifle or shotgun, rifles and shotguns have to be at all times unloaded and either disassembled or bound by a trigger lock. There's no exception for using them for home self-defense. So if you happen to have a shotgun, for example, in the house, and a bad guy breaks in, the only thing you can do with that shotgun is perhaps whack the intruder over the head with it or throw it at them. But having an operable firearm in Washington, D.C. is a misdemeanor.
Why is this case important? Why should people who either aren't interested in owning a gun or don't live or do business in D.C., why should they care?
Well, for many years, the movement to ban private firearms ownership in the United States has advocated a theory that the Second Amendment doesn't actually guarantee you any individual right to have a gun whatsoever. And in the absence of an individual constitutional right to have a gun, government is then free to regulate gun ownership out of existence. Sometimes they do it, as in D.C., by a fiat that simply bans guns, and sometimes they do it with the death of the thousand cuts, taxes, regulations, a scheme of regulation that basically makes gun ownership difficult and not impossible. So for us to establish it's a constitutional right would prevent the government from intruding on people's rights throughout the country.
The D.C. gun laws basically went into effect in 1976, these ultra-restrictive gun ownership regulations. What effect did that have on crime?
Well, it's tough to say that the D.C. gun ban has improved the crime situation. Within 15 years of the gun ban, the murder rate had tripled. The violent crime rate had gone through the roof. If anything, we know that criminals in Washington, D.C. still have guns, still obtain and use guns readily. They are undeterred by it. But law-abiding individuals are defenseless within their own homes. So, at best, it's done nothing to stop crime. It may have actually made the situation worse.
You're representing a number of plaintiffs. Could you talk about two of them in particular, Dick Heller, whose name is really the case is known by, and Shelley Parker? What is their story? Why did they want to own guns?
Okay. Shelley Parker moved into an improving neighborhood on Capitol Hill a number of years ago, and she found out the neighborhood was not improving fast enough. Shelley became very active in the community, trying to call the police, organize the citizens to get the drug dealers off the block. The drug dealers figured out fairly quickly what the source of their problems was and started harassing her. She had her security camera broken. She had a brick through a window. She had a man drive a car into her fence. And in fact, at one point, she had one of the drug dealers try to break into her home screaming, "Bitch, I'll kill you. I live here too." Shelley thought, I think quite reasonably, that she needs to have a gun to defend herself. The police are not always going to be able to defend her. Dick Heller has an interesting story as well. He lives in a crime-racked neighborhood, also on Capitol Hill. And during the day, however, he does have a gun. He has a gun when he goes to federal buildings and other city government buildings as well, government installations where he works as a security guard. He's allowed to have a gun on the job. He is what's called a special police officer of Washington, D.C. He has full arrest powers and everything else while he's on the job, and they give him a gun to do his job. But when it's time to clock out, the gun has to go in a safe, and he goes home defenseless and is not allowed to have a weapon at home.
How should the Supreme Court rule?
Well, the Supreme Court should first recognize that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right that belongs to you and I, ordinary members of the American community, to have arms. They should also recognize that handguns as a class of weapons clearly fall within the type of arms that are protected by the Second Amendment, and they should strike down both the handgun ban as well as the functional firearms ban.
How will the Supreme Court rule? And the ruling is due out any day.
Any day now, certainly by the end of June 2008 is the expectation. Well, it's hard to predict, prognosticate the Supreme Court, but the argument went very well, I thought at least. It seemed like the court was conversant with the ideas. It was a court that had read up on the issue and seemed open to recognizing Second Amendment rights. So I'm optimistic that the court will reach the correct decision.
If the Supreme Court strikes down the D.C. gun ban, that does not necessarily mean that the gun control will go away, or they could also tailor it so that it only affects D.C. Is that right?
Well, yes, that's true in both grounds. First of all, we don't have any absolute rights under the United States Constitution. This will not be the end of gun control and gun regulation, but it will put a stop to gun laws, or it should put a stop to gun laws that the government cannot demonstrate an actual need for and one which is respectful of individual rights. And so I think it should put the brakes and should impact certain gun control laws, the ones that are at least the least defensible. As far as the law's impact, we sued Washington, D.C. because it's a federal entity. We didn't have to deal with the stickier issue of whether or not the Second Amendment also binds the state governments. That will have to be left for future litigation.
Who was the most receptive, or did you sense was the most receptive justice to your arguments when you did oral arguments?
It's difficult for me to comment on individual justices, but I would say that many of the justices seemed receptive to the idea that the Second Amendment is a meaningful individual right, and there seemed to be broad support on the court, at least as far as we experienced the oral argument.
I hope you're not basing that on nods, because that could just be that they were falling asleep.
Right? No one fell asleep during the argument. It was quite a lively argument, and in fact, the audio transcript doesn't really capture the full spirit of the event. But no, it seemed like the court was open to the idea and was quite open to it, actually.
What? Who is your favorite Supreme Court justice currently sitting on the bench?
I'd like to let you know that in a few weeks once they rule.
And your least favorite, I suspect we'll have to wait for that.
I like them all.
Okay. Talk a little bit about your intellectual life, and your professional career, because you're 37, so you're pretty young to be arguing in front of the Supreme Court. You can only go downhill from here.
So I'll try
enjoy,
not to.
You know, before that happens, you know, tell us a little bit about where you're from and what's your ideological background, what's your intellectual heritage?
Sure. Well, I was born in Israel, but I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I've always had libertarian leanings. I can't think of any sort of epiphany or event or issue that suddenly turned me on to libertarian philosophy, but it's the way I approach the world. I believe that people should generally be free. We need government. Government does have a role in society, but it's a role which needs to be reduced from its current state.
What happens if you lose the case?
Well, I hope we don't lose this case, but if we lose the case, then that will be a teaching moment for America. I mean, we are going to have to come to terms with the fact that that we are losing our rights at an alarming rate. The Fourth Amendment jurisprudence from the court has been troubling. We've had an executive who has really quite interesting and expansive ideas of his authority. I think sometimes the administration forgets that the president is not the commander-in-chief of the country. He's only the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. I think that it's time that people take liberty seriously. We do have a wonderful constitution, a wonderful Bill of Rights. It protects a vast array of personal freedom. And it's time, I hope, that this case will sort of lead us in the other direction, perhaps get courts and judges to reflect more and give way to and meaning to our freedoms.
Thank you, Alan, very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV. Thanks for watching.